Hello and welcome to the Radio Academy podcast. I'm Laura Rawlings. I've lost count of the number of times that I've recommended the Shamima Begum story. It is a brilliant podcast series on BBC Sounds. It's a deep dive into Shamima Begum, who ran away from London aged 15 to join ISIS. And I am so pleased that we're focusing on it today with Josh Baker, who's the series creator. Shamima gave her version of the story to Josh, and he's been investigating what's been said and what hasn't in forensic detail. Here's a snippet from episode one.
Okay, so take me through the day you leave.
I woke up early in the morning, really early, like maybe 5-6 o'clock, because our flight left at like 12 o'clock. We just wanted to be there early.
I had to make an excuse as to why I was going. It was during the holiday, so I was just like, I have extra classes that I need to go to because I had my GCSEs coming up and my mum believed me.
She walked me to the bus stop. I just stood there with her, you know, just being quiet and stuff. She was just staring at me and not saying anything. I just said bye to her and I got on the bus and I left. I feel really guilty, obviously, not giving her a better goodbye, knowing that I would probably never see her again.
Shamima Begum is a very divisive figure in British society. Most adults have an opinion on her, and many journalists want to interview her. How do you tell a story like this and investigate the claims, especially when it involves going to hostile environments where the personal risks are huge? Why would you? Here's Josh.
Go back to 2015. I'm in East London Mosque, making a film not related to this series, and it becomes apparent that three girls from the local community have gone missing. Now, one of those girls is a lady called Shamima Begum, and she and her two friends had basically fled London, were on their way to join ISIS in Syria, and essentially would then disappear for 4 years before one of them, Shamima Begum, emerged from the ashes of the so-called ISIS caliphate. At that point, the British government decided she was a threat, took away her citizenship, and have left her in Syria ever since. And so this was a national news story from the moment it sort of broke, and people were trying to work out what was going on. And I sort of found myself in 2015 having this sort of bizarre front row seat, because the mosque became a focal point for her family, for the local community, and indeed for the authorities. And I'm sort of right there witnessing it all. And I followed the story for a bit and then stopped. And then 7 years later, I was in Syria for series one of the podcast. And I got a chance to sit down with Shamima Begum. We talked for about 45 minutes. And then she decided to give me what she said was her definitive account of the last 8-9 years, so to speak. And we then set about taking that apart for a 10-part podcast series, a 90-minute feature doc, a number of articles, live radio, and we tried to integrate it as much as possible with the BBC's output and beyond.
So in terms of like countries travelled, as you have been taking the story apart, tell us, just run through the countries that you've been to.
England, obviously. Turkey, all around Turkey, we uncovered a IS people smuggling network in Turkey, and then an intelligence operation that had gone wrong.
That was a scary episode.
Yeah, it was interesting. And then an awful lot of time in Syria, northeast Syria, a bunch of time in Raqqa, the former capital of the so-called ISIS caliphate. We hired a flat there and lived there for a bit. Iraq, France, Germany, I think that's it.
Yeah, wow. And in terms of the numbers of people working with you on this, can you give us a sense of that? I appreciate it will have gone up and down at different stages in the process, but...
Yeah, I mean, so it massively changes depending on where we are and what we're doing. So if we're in sort of Syria, for example, there's myself, my fellow co-writer, Joe Kent, and our producer, Sara Abadat, who is Jordanian and is an investigative journalist as well. So the three of us are sort of the core team, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then there are, it sort of grows if we have local staff with us, local producers, drivers. I tend to shoot everything myself. So that's one less role. I think the thing is it depends. So if I'm working in a hostile environment or a war zone, I want the smallest crew possible. So that's when I take on more roles, because I want the smallest footprint. I want us to blend in. I want less people at risk. But then if I'm working in somewhere like Turkey, you know, we could get somebody else in to do the filming. So it depends on the environment and the tools that you need, basically.
How did you get to the position where Shamima Begum would talk to you and want to give you her definitive story? And did you feel excited that you had landed one of the biggest stories that lots of people have an opinion on?
Excited, possibly, but also in a way I felt like, perhaps arrogantly, because I had been there at the beginning, because I had followed it, because I had filmed with the families, because I had written about it, because I had spent so much time, you know, of my professional career understanding ISIS and extremism and had that historical context, I possibly felt like I was one of the best people to take it on. Now, a lot of people will disagree with that, but I felt very well placed. I suppose when I attained the interview, I felt slightly daunted by the task at hand, because just because you've got the interview, and we sort of had to remind some people of this in the BBC, it doesn't mean you have the story, because you don't know if anything she said is true. So sort of that was just the first stepping stone in what would become a multi-year experience. In terms of obtaining the interview, this is quite a funny thing. Obviously, this is a hugely competitive story.
Yeah.
And, you know, certain sects of the press decided that I must have paid her, or I must have, like, coerced her in some way, you know, which would, and essentially the Americans would call it being material support for terrorism. You'd be funding terrorism because she is designated, recognised as a terrorist. And actually, how that came about was Shamima Begum being aware of some of the previous work we'd done. Shamima Begum being aware that I'd recorded an interview between, well, sorry, I'd recorded a phone call between her best friend and a family member. The best friend had called from Raqqa, and that tape was very important to her because it was the last piece of audio of her friend who died. But more than anything, it came about because of my time in the NGO sector. So before I worked as a journalist, I used to work in, I worked a bit for Save the Children, other charities, but I also worked for charities similar to Samaritans. Mm-hmm. And all this is to say is that there's a very strict consent process you go through before you interview anyone in those worlds. And I tend to apply that in my work. So in essence, what I did is I really sat and talked with Shamima for about 45 minutes, no recording equipment, about what this would look like, how far reaching it would be, whether it was the right thing for her to do. And in also try to explain that I will not always agree with her, but I will always be fair and factual. And I sort of come at this at the prism from myself of having been blown up by ISIS, having spent years speaking to survivors of their crimes. I have friends of friends who were sadly decapitated in those videos. So I'm not blind to their brutality, but I do believe in following the facts and being fair.
So given what you've just said about your, you know, being blown up by ISIS and what's happened to friends, is that why you want to do more stories covering ISIS? Is that why you wanted to cover this story?
I suppose I have always been interested in extremism and conflict, and in various forms. But I think, you know, I was coming up as a journalist at a time when ISIS was the big story.
Yeah.
And I was in a community doing something unrelated to this, where people from this community were leaving to go and join this group. And so I sort of was exposed to it in a way that I'd not really ever imagined you would be as a journalist. And then you start to travel to the region and work in these areas and things like that, and sort of see the impact. And it just became an all-consuming interest, because what was interesting to me about ISIS is, unlike any previous terror group really, they had formulated a state the size of Britain, right, spanning Iraq and Syria. So they had created something which had this air of legitimacy, and then they created an awesome propaganda machine which was selling a message. And I became so fascinated, less in terms of the bang bang or anything like that and the shooting and the violence, more of the ideology behind the creation of this state and wanting to understand it.
What's it been like inhabiting what I think is a really dark space for this period of time?
Do you know, I used to say I'm really good at mental health, but what's interesting is, so I last had a holiday in 2017, and that was just after I was blown up. So if you think from sort of from the middle of 2017 onwards, I have worked pretty much nonstop on the I'm Not a Monster series. And so series one was, we used to joke that there was probably no form of evil that wasn't covered in the series. I mean, it was obscene. And then sort of finished that, and then series two came about with Shamima Begum. And I think my reserves were pretty depleted going into it. And as you say, it is so hard to convey to people how difficult it is on so many levels. And so it sort of becomes all consuming and you don't really get much of a life outside work. And certainly for the last episode, I was living at the BBC. I hadn't gone home for 3 or 4 days, and we finished the episode 2 hours before. And that's the sort of level it got to before everything else.
Then, after a sleepless night waiting for Sharmina to come online, and less than 24 hours before the release of this episode, I confront her.
Hello, my name is Josh, and I understand that this message will probably be quite surprising to you. Basically, for a long time, I've been speaking with Shamima Begum as part of a podcast series looking at everything that happened around this.
I explain who I am. At first, she texts back saying she's not Sharmina, but then I reveal I know a lot about her, and she admits it's her, and tells me she's in hiding, and that it could.
The story was revealing itself to you as it was going along. So, how on earth do you condense all of this? What was your sort of general principle? Did you get to a point where you had that? Obviously, you've got the story in your head as to the other, you know, core members of your team, and you sit down, and you go, right, episode one is going to be this, and that will hook into two. Can you do it like that? How does it work?
It's kind of, so it's a really interesting question, actually. It's a really good question. So, I mean, you know, making a 10-part narrative series is a huge undertaking, no matter the subject matter, because you've got to get arcs. You've got to have a narrative arc that's going to sustain for 10 episodes, multiple hours. But then when you throw in a film component as well, it becomes like a real Rubik's Cube that you have to kind of solve. But when you bring it into podcast, you're basically trying to really immerse people in a world. And you have this beauty in podcast where you can be going along a sort of narrative. Okay, Shamima Begum disappears from London. She makes it into Turkey. She's transported by a man providing information to Canadian intelligence. Okay, but let's hit pause for a second. Now let's go back and understand how she got herself into this mess. So you can interrupt the chronology. You can also go into cul-de-sacs, as we call them, and just look at a thing and then come back. So episode 8, for example, is the day Anthony Lloyd, or the day leading up to Anthony Lloyd, the Times journalist, found Shamima Begum. So although it's Shamima Begum's story, we put Shamima down and we just pick up with Anthony for an episode. And so you get this freedom with narrative creation that's very exciting. And actually episode 8 was the first episode I wrote, because I was like, that is a clear, leads to the episode 8 or 9, that's a clear thing. What we try to do is work out what the key beats are in a story, and then how we think we're going to sustain them and what the scenes are that we need for that to tell that story. And I try to do that before I go anywhere, right? I work out what are the beats that I need to understand. Right. Now, inevitably, that changes when you're on the ground. And I try to think about it like this, that so in essence, the process of planning is more important than the plan itself, because it gives you a concept and a focus. And then when you're on the ground and it changes, you can adapt. But when you're on the ground and you're really tired and you can't remember why you're here, you can go back to the plan and understand what it was that you set out to do.
Got it.
In addition, I would say what you want as well from most stories or most scenes is you're always looking for the small window with a big view. So you want that person or that environment that is focused but somehow encapsulates a wider narrative.
One of the other things that I think people have noticed, and when I tell people about the series, and they're like, well, what does he think? So you'll get this all the time. But what does he really think about Shamima Begum? Because you don't ever say in it. That is a real skill, to keep asking the questions but never actually give your opinion or sound like you're coming from a position.
But you know, I think this is interesting because in a way, I get asked these questions sometimes of like, you know, would this story have been easier if you hadn't been working for the BBC? And I actually, you know, the BBC is committed to impartiality and I think it's the perfect story for the BBC. I really do. And I think too often today, journalism is blurring with activism. Now, I'm an old school sort of purist in the sense of, like, obviously I have a personal opinion and obviously I'm a human being and I feel things, but that's not my job. My job is to, in an empathetic manner, present the facts as clearly as possible and allow people to make up their own decision.
Definitely. What was the most important skill or experience that you have that helped you get through this series and get it over the finish line?
I think so. In terms of the actual creation of it, I'm an investigative journalist, so I know how to find information. But at the same time, I think it's just listening to people, like actually properly listening to people. I think it's a skill that is so important to really engage in active listening, because contributors tell you so much. They tell you their lies, they tell you their truths, and they reveal things that they might not realize they've revealed. Little details when they're describing to you, you know, a location that they might have passed through and they just mention something distinctive about that location. Oh, that little detail that they thought was irrelevant has now allowed me to go away. So, for example, I find Shamima Begum's best friend in episode 10. In a conversation where she thought I was an ISIS member, she mentioned the weather and she mentioned a couple of other details, which I won't say just here. And within 30 minutes, I'd located where she works by looking at weather patterns and a couple of things. So just actively listening and engaging with people gives you a wealth of information to then process. I think to get through it, I remember a week where I'd had just a ton of threats. Some of my family had started to experience abuse. My cousin had just died. The subject matter was really draining me and I hadn't slept properly in probably about 6 weeks. And I was just in this pursuit. And also everyone in our industry at rival papers and some in-house journalists was being critical or analysing it, what have you. So it felt like the weight of the world was upon you. And at that point, I knew that it had become sort of like almost like a relentless pursuit. I had to just keep going. And I knew if I could keep going through it at that moment that I would probably be able to take on most things. But I think the key factors that really got me through it were the team. The thing to remember is nobody makes you do this. You choose to do this. It's the same when you step into a conflict zone, right? You're choosing to step in and there's an important distinction. Mm. And also, I would say, sorry, last thing, when you take somebody's testimony, no matter who it is, you take on an obligation to tell that testimony fairly and truthfully. And I really feel the responsibility of that in everyone I speak to. Even if it's a guy at the side of the road who just has a little slither of information, I think you take on a responsibility and that can be used as a really good motivator at times.
What do you feel about it now and the impact that it's had?
We always knew it would get a lot of attention. I think none of us understood how much. I mean, we've done more than 60 or 70 interviews. We've produced a feature documentary, 10-part series. We've fed the spectrum of the media. We've done a weekly live radio show. I mean, the list goes on. Millions of people have read our online pieces. So it's extraordinary. But at the same time, I'm really happy because I designed it as a story to be truly multi-platform. And I designed it as a story where I wanted it to have the maximum reach into not only the BBC, but the wider media landscape. And I think we fulfilled that. And the only thing that I can say on a personal level is for the best part of 2 years, I've sort of worked with what felt like a lead weight in my stomach. And after the last episode where went out and I woke up for the first Monday in 2 or 3 years where I didn't have to work, I remember feeling this amazing lightness. Just, I felt like, oh, the stress is gone. And so now I would say it's over to the audience, right? We've done our job and now it's over to you to make up your mind about Shamima Begum. And that's a wonderful feeling for me.
So do you know what you're doing next, Josh?
I think what is next? So first of all, I need to find out where my home is.
Right.
Where am I working? Am I working at the BBC? Am I working somewhere else? I don't yet know where my home is. But I'm going to take a break for a bit. I've got about 2 months off now, I've allowed myself. I have lots of ideas. I have probably 3 or 4 really good ideas. I made something on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict about 10 years ago. And I think that is a really thorny issue that could benefit from the same type of journalism. And so I'm looking at potentially doing that. There's also something I'd like to do on Ukraine in a very different way, take audio into that space in a very different way. So there's lots of options. But the first thing I'm going to do is next week I'm going to go to Moroccan Health Spa, which I've never done before, and stay there for a week.
Yeah.
And have a massage and heal.
Even after listening to Josh, it's still hard to completely imagine the personal impact of covering a story like that. And I'm glad he's taking a proper break. Josh mentioned being blown up by ISIS. And if you want more on that story, listen to the award-winning series one of I'm Not a Monster on BBC Sounds. I feel that we've just scratched the surface here, but if it encourages you to listen to all of the episodes of the story, then that's a good thing. I'm going to be back next week, where it's all about the Arias. Thank you so much for listening.